Hello and good morning and welcome to the original Loretta Brown Show, radio to open the heart, heal the soul, and awaken the consciousness. Good morning, Mr. Benny Mathers. What's happening in your section of the world?
My section? I'm not too far off of where your section is.
Actually, we're right next door to each other.
I know.
So,
well, close. I mean, we can't really high five, but we're a few miles away, I believe. Yeah,
I figure, yeah. I can do it.
Wait, if I just look close enough, I can look right over the top there of those trees. I don't think I can see you waving. There it is.
There it is.
I got you.
Me. Okay, good. So how's life? How is the past week?
Life is pretty good, you know, in the Pacific Northwest. Our newly redesigned backyard is now flourishing, which is nice. And we're excited to use it here in a couple of weeks. We can't get on it quite right yet. We had some new lawn put down and so forth, so we're excited.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should send pictures. I love that kind of redo stuff.
That went our summer plans, basically, too. But that's okay.
Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. I love that. A lot of redo stuff going on.
I can feel it in the air for sure.
Mm-hmm. I can, too. Kind of freshening things up, cluttering, decluttering, getting it out there. I love the before and after shows of anything, right?
Oh,
like
who doesn't?
Anything. It's like, oh yeah, I love that.
It inspires me.
Yeah,
I remember some of those old like daytime television shows that always grabbed like viewers and listeners like that as far as watching. It was always like, you know, someone who hasn't had like a makeover in like 45 years, and they always dress them normally, and then they like vamped them in an hour with like the staff from the show. And of course, you're gonna get like some amazing before and afters, but those are always my favorite shows to watch.
Yeah, me too. And they come out and people are like, oh my God.
Right.
You know,
and then like 2 weeks later, they just go back to what they were doing. I've been watching.
Yeah, it's probably true. Yeah. I've been watching these people that cut people's hair, you know, because they've just been popping up. And I'm always like, or they, you know, they come in and they're all way so much hair, beards and like, everything. And then pretty soon.
Glamified. Like, yeah. So forth like that. I don't have any hair on my head. I don't have very much left. So I got to work from somewhere else.
You're glamoury just like that.
Stop. Baby. I wish I could put some just little like ding-ling, ding-ling around my eyes right now. That'd be amazing.
I wish you could. Sparkles. Little sparkly thing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Anyway. Yeah. I love it. So I am Loretta Brown. I'm the owner of what? Reiki Oasis.
Look. Where do you remember where you were again?
I don't know. You know, I'm going to talk about this Scorpio full moon this week, but I am disoriented.
Uh-oh.
Like, I don't know what day it is. I think it's Thursday.
That's a good start. You're one for one. Okay. Batting 1,000. All right. Here we go.
I'm going to hang in there. Anyway, I'm the owner of Reiki Oasis, located right here in the greater Seattle area for, you know, 28, 29, 30 years. I never know quite for sure. I think I started my business in 1995. So somebody gets to do the math. You can find out more about me at ReikiOasis.com or sign up for things at schedule.ReikiOasis.com. So like I said, how's everybody doing? We had a Scorpio full moon on Tuesday, and this full moon was also known as the pink moon and the Buddha moon. And oh my goodness, people posted the most amazing pictures. Some guy in the Seattle area takes lovely shots with the Space Needle. And he's got the moon right behind the Space Needle. And people up in the Skagit Valley posted pictures. And it was stunning. It was big and stunning. So this is an astrological event shrouded in mystery. Scorpio is known for its depth, passion, and resilience. It lends its enigmatic qualities to the pink full moon, intensifying its impact on our lives and the cosmos. The moon is not comfortable in Scorpio. It doesn't really like it there. And so under the influence of Scorpio's penetrating gaze, the full moon becomes a mirror reflecting our innermost desires, fears, and secrets, which encourages us to dive into the depths of our shadows, our psyche, and just kind of take a look at it. Some people were not as affected by this moon as other people. You know, it can be very individual, but it is a time for emotional and spiritual rebirth and purging as we release anything that is not authentically who we are. Now, the pink full moon in Scorpio is also a catalyst for transformation and evolution. And that has been a never-ending theme from me for a couple of years, if not the whole month of April, right? And like the mythical phoenix rising from the ashes, we're called to shed our old selves and emerge renewed, revitalized, and empowered. It's a very potent time to get rid of outdated ideas, outdated patterns, and actually goes along with what Mr. Benny was talking about redoing his backyard or any of the redo shows. This is the perfect time for kind of sprucing yourself up a little bit. And also because we entered Taurus, and Taurus is all about health and the body. And I was talking to one of my clients yesterday. So many of my clients are losing weight. So good on all of you for doing that, or getting active again, or getting outside. And
I mean, Loretta, really it is up and coming bikini season. So that's why we're dropping a lot of weight. So, you know.
I know. Well, I can carry a bikini around. Just saying. You gotta get it going on. Yeah, and that's part of it too. That's very much it. The Scorpio Taurus way. You are right on there. You should be an astrologer, Benny. You got it going.
Why would I be one when you're already mine own? So I mean,
well,
it's personal.
There you go.
There you go.
It's personal. Yeah, I can give you personal. Yeah. So when they call this full moon the Buddha moon, like I said, there's a different name for it in different parts of the world. This is the time when the life, enlightenment, and transition of Buddha is celebrated. So it's a very spiritual moon. Who knew? We're invited to embrace the depths of our being and emerge stronger, wiser, and more authentically ourselves. So it's kind of a call for, I don't know, I kind of look at it like open the doors of the underworld and come on out. And let's take a look at what happened during that time of transition. And then today, I don't know, maybe we need clapping or cheering, because guess what? Mercury goes direct today.
Woo-hoo!
Woo-hoo!
Yeah!
Woo-hoo! Yeah! Woo-hoo!
Makes my life easier for sure. Makes my life so much easier.
I love it. My astrologer friend Carol Barbeau posts this little meme, and it shows the Glenda, the good witch, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she's standing there, and she's going, come out, wherever you are. Mercury's direct. Like, you can come back out now. Anyway.
She could sing anything that's even bad, make it good. Like, it's the smelliest garbage ever, but that's okay. You know, I mean, right.
Right, exactly.
You can't go wrong with that. She had such a great voice.
She had a great voice and a great presence, and I like her outfit. Totally. And I want the magic wand, right? You know, have it. Yeah. So anyway, it's always recommended to wait until Mercury leaves its post-retrograde shadow before signing long-term contracts or making expensive travel or electronic purchases. And Mercury will be out of shadow by May 15th. As Mercury stations direct, it often leaves a gift or some piece of information that can be helpful. So stay open to any messages that you may receive today, or even kind of take a look at what area of your life is highlighted as we start to move forward. On Sunday, Mars conjuncts Neptune in Pisces, which can bring fiery passion to our hopes and dreams. And we might be feeling more in touch with what motivates us and brings us joy. And I got to tell you, I think we could use some more joy. Mars and Neptune can also create a desire to escape reality. So be a little bit careful with that. Be lean toward healthy ways of doing that rather than unhealthy. And take a couple of breaths before you leap. Also during this time, be sure you're nurturing your body and looking after yourself. It is a little bit of time for some indulgence, but you know, everything in moderation is my thing. And then on Monday, April 29th, Venus moves into its ruling sign of Taurus, and Venus loves being in Taurus. It's like, oh, I'm so happy I'm home. I'm home, honey. And I'm feeling a little bit romantic and wanting to crave comfort. So for all of you romantics out there, this is a great time for something luxurious, something lovely. And I don't know, it is a good time to bring transitions to your home, Mr. Benny, or to your wardrobe, right? And it's a great time to schedule beauty appointments.
Mr.
If you're single.
What are you saying?
I'm saying it for myself too.
I know.
I'm just giving you a big thumbs up for everything you're doing because you're just right you. On. Yeah.
That's funny.
So if you're single or in a relationship, Venus and Taurus can add an extra layer of support to help you find a deeper layer of love and harmony. And on Tuesday, April 30, Mars moves into its ruling sign of Aries. So Mars is in Aries and Venus in Taurus, and Mars and Venus are the celestial lovers. And so there's going to be a lot of passionate energy. So you might feel more motivated and confident to tackle whatever is coming up for you. And of course, it's just a great time to, you know, I don't know, love on each other a little bit, you know, be kind, be gentle. Kind of shake yourself off from all the tough things and catch our breath, you know, before we go into whatever's coming next. And here's a great Taurus energy chant, because we are in the season of Taurus now. You are worthy. You were born worthy. You need nothing outside of yourself to claim or own just how worthy you truly are. So that's our report. And on the back end of that, I'm going to bring in a very worthy person. Ooh, my guest today is Joanne DiMaggio, M-A-C-H-T, and from 1964 to 1972, Joanne DiMaggio was the president of a Beatles fan club. 15 years later, she began pursuing a career as a past life, a researcher and therapist. And in those ensuing years, she always wondered how she, a Catholic girl from an Italian-American family living in Chicago's South Side, went from being passionate about the Beatles to becoming passionate about reincarnation research. Did anything happen during the heyday of Beatlemania that may have planted a seed leading her to an esoteric career long after the group disbanded? We're going to talk about that today. In her new book, The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls, she shares her personal story. And since we just passed the 60th anniversary, I believe, of Beatles arriving in New York, is the perfect time for this discussion, this conversation, this funness. Welcome to the show, Joanne.
Thanks, Loretta. I'm really glad to see you again.
I'm really glad to see you. And we were giggling before the show. We got the memo to wear the right colors today.
Right.
Yeah. So we did just pass the 60th anniversary of them coming, right?
Right. It was February 7th, 1964. It's when they landed in New York.
Wow. I have to go back in my memory, way back in my memory. Anybody listening? Wow. 64. Yeah, that 60s were such a wild and crazy time of change, right?
Oh, they were. And I do think that because of that, we were really ripe for a massive energetic change to happen. And certainly the Beatles brought that to us.
Lay the foundation for it just a little bit, because there were things happening, you know, kind of set the stage for what was the era, what was going on at the time they showed up.
Well, you know, in November of 63 is when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And here come the Beatles just a few months later. And I think that we were really in a era of mourning. I think, and mostly, I do believe it was my generation that felt the heaviness of this time. There was really a dark cloud that had sort of descended over the country. And we had lost a lot of hope for the future that the Kennedys had given us. And so, you know, this was early on in the, you know, we had the Vietnam War, and then many other things would happen during the course of the 60s, you know, the civil rights movement and you know, a lot of other things going on politically that was changing us culturally. And that was changing us also spiritually. So I think that we were just, it was the right time for something to come in and lift us out of the doldrums. Like, how could we fill that hole that we felt? And the Beatles music certainly did that. And the group as a whole did that.
You know, I was a little kid, very little. And I think my older sister was a more appropriate age. But, you know, I'm going to tell you, share this story because it's so fun. I remember that on Sunday evenings, we usually went to church, but my dad said, no, we're not going to church. We're going to watch the Ed Sullivan Show, right? And I was like, why are we watching the Ed Sullivan Show, Dad? And he said, because the Beatles are going to be singing. I thought he meant insects. I thought it was like a cartoon, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. And then on they came and everybody was screaming. And I remember looking at them, and even at that little age that I was, I knew it was a moment in history.
Yeah.
So talk about that. Go ahead.
Dad, I'm surprised your dad initiated that, because it was the other way around, where the kids begging their parents to put the Ed Sullivan Show on.
Well, and I remember Dad saying to me after the show, he said, you just watched history in the making. And I, to this day, you know, my dad would sometimes come out with these things. Like, he always had me reading things behind the scenes, like The Power of Positive Thinking and Edgar Cayce. I read all that stuff. He says, don't tell your mother we're reading these books. Right. But talk about it a little bit, because they came on and they had long hair and they had the Beetle boots and they had. So their effect upon us, I don't even know where to begin with that conversation, because I feel like it's enormous. But talk about your experience and just jump in there any way that you want.
Well, I was having some things going on in my personal life, as well as, you know, dealing with what was going on politically and culturally. In my own family, there was a split that was going on due to the death of my grandparents, my grandmother. And so the family was splitting apart, and that I come from an Italian American family. And so when family issues come up, they come up.
I'm sorry, that's just making me laugh so much. I went, oh my goodness. Yes. Yeah. Keep talking. Keep talking.
So I had a very beloved cousin who, and the kids get, you know, when the parents are arguing with their siblings, it's like the kids get caught in the crossfire, and that's what happened. So I was losing touch with this cousin of mine that I thought of as a sister. I loved her so much. And so I was especially sad and looking for something. And so when my girlfriend Doreen said, you know, introduced me to the Beatles, I went to her house. I'll never forget. She's playing a record. I saw her standing there, and she was pretending to be George, and she's kind of moving around like George. And so, you know, you get all caught up in the excitement of the music and how it made you happy, and you're smiling and you're dancing. And those were things I wasn't doing before, because I was just so depressed over what was going on. So, I mean, I got hooked right then and there, and I decided that the Beatles were going to be a part of my life on a very deep and profound level. Of course, I was thinking that subconsciously, not consciously. But what I did think consciously was that I wanted to start a club, fan club for them. I knew that I was a fairly good writer, even at that age. I was really good at organizing. So I thought, well, this would be a way of bringing like-minded people together. So even at that young age, I was thinking in terms of networking, of bringing people that believe the same thing together, so that we could, you know, sort of boost each other's spirits and become friends and family. That was the theme all through this for me personally, was finding my family again. So that's what I did. I started a Beatles fan club, and you know, started to put together a newsletter on my mother's old clunker Underwood typewriter.
The typewriter. Is that a manual typewriter? Click, click.
Yeah,
click,
those big, click. Heavy, you know.
Oh, yeah, they're huge.
Where you had to pound on the keys, you know, because that's all that we had. So that's how I learned to type, was on, my mother taught me when I was in eighth grade. So by the time I got to high school, I was pretty fast, especially when they introduced the electric typewriter. I thought, oh, I've died and gone to heaven. But anyway, I was trying to do a monthly newsletter and building the club. I was looking in the back of Beatle magazines, and they used to run a list of pen pals. Remember pen pals?
I
And
do.
I started writing to all these people saying, "Hey, I've got a fan club. Do you want to join?" So that was my first entree into marketing. So all the things that I was doing as a kid, now I could look back and say, "Yeah, that's where you started. That's where you learned how to do a database. That's how you learned how to do public relations work and all this other stuff." So it was a remarkable time of transformation for me, and it filled up my days and my, and that loneliness that I was feeling otherwise.
So this just spontaneously came out of you, and you're like, "Oh yes, there's the Beatles, and yes, I'm going to start this fan club, and I'm going to find my people, my
Yeah,
peeps."
I didn't want
Yeah,
to be just a fan. I mean, for me,
right.
that was like I knew that I could do more if given the chance. And so I thought, well, I'll this will be fun. It wasn't fun, but I thought it was going to be fun. And so that's why I started the club. And I started the club to bring people together so that I could find other Beatle fans in my immediate neighborhood. And then obviously through pen pals, through writing to people, and that started to expand my world view. And so it just kind of grew from there.
So how long did you run that fan club? And tell us a little more about that, because you did this on your own, and then somewhere along the line, the bigger fan club came in, I'll say. So follow through on that a little bit, because I heard you very clear, like it wasn't always fun.
There were hundreds of Beatle fan clubs across the country, so I don't want you to think I was the president of the definitive Beatle fan club. Any fan that wanted to start a fan club could back then, and we did. And as it turned out, and my fan club had a lot of I was going to say it's reincarnated over and over again because I kept changing the name. It evolved. It evolved into different names. The newsletter got bigger, had more members, started to do all sorts of things. Like we had meetings at, I was living in Chicago at the time, so we had meetings in the hotels downtown. So we were going along, and then all of a sudden, I get a letter from the Beatles USA Limited, which was the fan club in New York, which was under the auspices of Apple Records. So Apple Records at the time had an office in New York City, and the official Beatles fan club was being run out of that office. At that time, they were called Beatles USA Limited, and they it's pretty much a cease and desist letter, where they're telling, and they sent it to all the fan clubs, like, you can't just have your own fan club. You have to be a part of us. You have to be a chapter of our club. And to be a chapter of our club, we need you to have your members join us. And we need, I don't know how many members they needed. The dues were like ridiculously low at that point, 250 for the year. At the time, we thought that was high. And they needed, I think, 50. Or I don't know how many people they never got, but anyway, and so of course I just became all incensed. I thought, how dare you? We could do what we want. You can't tell me I can't have a Beatle fan club. So I went and enlisted the help of Jim Stagg, who was a disc jockey at WCFL radio in Chicago, and I wrote him a letter. He printed my letter in the Chicago Sun-Times. He had a column called the Stag Line, and he printed that. And then he tried calling the New York office, and they wouldn't return his phone calls. So after a while, things got quiet again, and I thought, aha, the fact that I got him involved, they're going to leave us alone. It didn't last very long, and then pretty soon they came after us again. And they put so much
Wow.
pressure on all the clubs that eventually, out of I think 100 fan clubs, there were only three left that were holdouts, and mine was one of them. And so they sort of really worked on me a little bit, and they threw a carrot in there for me. They said, "Listen, how about if you become our national chapter director, which would mean that all the chapters across the country would report to you, and we'll give you a little stipend every month." So I could brag I was on Apple's payroll. Ha ha. It was only $25 a month, didn't cover anything. But anyway, that's what happened. And then at that same time, they were divvying out fan clubs for each Beatle. So there was an official George Harrison fan club, John Lennon, Ringo Starr, and then Paul McCartney's was available, and they offered that to me, and I accepted that. So that's how we evolved into the official Paul McCartney fan club, and how I became national chapter director.
Wow, I have so many mixed feelings about everything you just said. First of all, you started this on your own, and then this bigger organization came in to put it under their umbrella. It's just a curious thing for me as to why did they feel they needed to, control what was going on there? That's how it feels to me.
Yeah, I think they were concerned about copyright on the photographs that were being sold in the fan clubs. They were concerned about misinformation getting out there, because remember, we didn't have the internet then. So we were getting all of our information through the newspaper, magazine articles, or what we would hear on the radio. And so by the time we would get that information, print it, and send it out, it was pretty old. And I even had members of my club complaining about that. Your information is old. You don't have anything new to tell us. Why should I bother to stay a member? So they had the caveat of, we'll get you original photographs to sell. We will send out the information, news, and it'll be truthful, and you'll have it right away. So yeah, there were some, like I said, they had some carrots at the end of the stick that made it enticed us, and they kept assuring us we could still do our own newsletters, we could still do what we were doing, but it had to be under the watchful eye of Apple, of the official Beatles fan club. Yeah.
So when you transitioned over to that, the national chapter director, how much longer did the fan club go before it was came to an end? I don't
Not
know.
much longer. It ended in 1972. We had heard rumblings that it was going to end sooner than that, when Paul quit the group, and I think for a couple of years, actually, things were pretty unsteady. But what happened was George Harrison's fan club, which, by the way, was one of the best fan clubs in this country. The president of that club actually had a relationship with George's family, and they did some wonderful work. But she sent he got a hold of a copy of the newsletter, didn't like what he read. We're still to this day not sure what that was. And based on that, he just became incensed about it, and he went into the Apple offices in London, and called them on the carpet and said, "What is this? Why is, first of all, there are no more Beatles. There should be no more Beatle fan clubs." And Paul had done the same thing. He had said, "There are no more Beatles. I don't want anything to do with anything that has the word Beatles in it." So they made the decision at that point that they were going to just disband. They actually tried to hold the official club together under a new name called the Apple Tree. They were trying to do it for all Apple record artists. That didn't fly with me because I didn't really want to do a fan club for all the other Apple artists. So anyway, in 1972, that was our swan song. I think a lot of the independent fan clubs went back to being independent. They didn't care that they probably were happy that they were no longer, but they didn't care that George and Paul didn't want them to have a fan club anymore. And they kept their fan clubs going, but I didn't though. I let mine go. Yeah.
Well, I have so many questions for you. I'm so appreciative of you sharing your experiences. Joanne DiMaggio is my guest today. The Inner Light: How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Soul. And we're going to take a little station break. Don't go away, because when we come back, we're going to go a little deeper into this. I have a very strong, I don't even know what the right word is. The way that our landscape changes, through our society, through our culture, and particularly our music. I think we need to just dive into that a little bit more. And also because of the, I call it the spiritual evolution or revolution that was happening in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even on up to the present moment. So don't go away. This is Loretta Brown, my guest, Joanne DiMaggio, The Inner Light. We're going to talk more about the Beatles and spirituality when we get back.
You should do a podcast. Ever hear this from someone? Maybe you brushed it off. Yeah, right. Me, a podcast. Well, you might be surprised. Podcasting can be easy and affordable. But like anything else, you're gonna have to get educated. Why not share your voice? Say what you want to say and say it professionally with a produced podcast. Call 425-653-1020. That's 425-653-1020. Because hey, you know what? You should do a podcast.
Energy is powerful. It's all around us, mysterious, full of potential. Directing positive, healing energy to raise your vibrational rate through Reiki can change your life. Reiki Master Loretta Brown has relieved stress, sadness, anger, and even helped clients lose weight, stop smoking, and end sleep disorders. Worldwide, people have sought out Reiki Oasis. If you want help with your dis-ease, visit ReikiOasis.com. Harness life's energy. Visit ReikiOasis.com today.
I just got a text asking me to approve a bank transfer I didn't make. I bet you get messages like this too. So much of our lives are online today, from email to banking and everything in between. To make sure my information was protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World website for simple steps to stay safe online. Now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at CISA.gov/secureourworld.
Need help getting started with self-help? You came to the right place. Alternative Talk, 1150.
Wow, thank you. We can identify that piece of music, can't we, Joanne? Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
George, yeah.
That says it all.
Yeah, it says it all. Anyway, we'll get back to that in a minute. Welcome back to the original Loretta Brown Show with my guest, Joanne DiMaggio. Her book, The Inner Light, How the Beatles Planted the Spiritual Seed in Our Souls. You should just go buy it right now. It's a really great book. It's well written. She's got pictures in it. I love that part. And a reminder that these shows are archived. You can download them for free at the KKNW 1150 AM archives for the original Loretta Brown Show. And we're on iTunes, Podcast One, Spotify X, YouTube, Audible. I don't know. We're all over the place. So please go check it out. Yes, that piece of music, Benny is so spot on. He's so spot on. So talk to me let's just jump in. Tell us about that piece of music.
Well, I have to admit that when George started to get into the Indian culture, and when they went to see Ravi Shankar in India, first of all, we lost a lot of members when that happened. There were moments in Beatlemania that we would lose members. And when John made this statement about Jesus, about the group being more popular than Jesus, we lost a lot of members. When they admitted they took LSD, we lost a lot of members. And then when they went to India, same thing happened. It's because a lot of us could not relate to what was going on. I didn't personally resonate to the sound of the music. It was the sound that I didn't like. So I would not listen to it. I would just skip over it. It wasn't until I actually got past that and started to look at the lyrics that I realized how profound they were. And it's interesting because, you know, without going out of, you know, I can know all things. That's what happens when you do a regression, right? When you do a past life regression, you're not leaving your home. You're just sitting there and you have access to who you had been all over any place in the world, right? And all this knowledge and wisdom kind of comes pouring into you during the course of a session. So in a way, it sort of foretold, well, you know, where my energies were going to go when I much later. So that was an interesting time. Like I said, some of us followed it. George hung in there. He's the only one really that stayed with it to the depth that he did. And you know, those of us who were following along and actually taking the time to listen to the lyrics, we're having some changes happening within us as well.
I'm thinking back, you know, I would remember when my sister would get the new album, right? She was very much into listening to music, and the album covers began to change. So from She Loves You, Yeah, 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 to what we just heard is such a journey. And I very much appreciate what you said, that you didn't really resonate with every single thing that was going on. They were going through some sort of an evolution and possibly a spiritual awakening of some kind. The LSD, thinking about Timothy O'Leary and all of the experimentation with all of that and lifestyles and whatnot. But so even Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, I remember the album cover for that. I would stare at it because it was so much going on in it.
So much there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the lyrics. So we know that sound and vibration carry something in them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So when they went to India and they went with Ravi Shankar and also the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, pull out some of that information for us. And also, like you said, the transition that you were observing. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the biggest thing I took out of all of that was that when they learned how to do the transcendental meditation. So if nothing else, that was something that stayed with them. Now I know Ringo didn't last more than 2 weeks out there and he couldn't handle it. He came home, and then right after that, Paul joined him. He left. John hung in there a little bit longer. George was the longest one. It's interesting because, you know, he learned to play the sitar from Ravi Shankar. And I have a quote in my book from Ravi Shankar, in which he said that, you know, he was a little surprised at, you know, it didn't make any sense that George had this deep, deep interest in the culture, in the, you know, playing the instrument and the music and the sound and all of that. He goes, yeah, it doesn't make any sense unless you believe in reincarnation. Well, yeah, of course, right? That reincarnation answers every question. So that was George's connection. He did believe he had a past life there. So I think he was just picking up on where he left off. I mean, I don't know that's for a fact, because I didn't do a regression with him, and I don't know that he ever actually did a regression, but the fact that they learned the transcendental meditation, I think, is something, especially Paul and John and George, infused in their music. As a matter of fact, I have a whole chapter in my book on where I call them soul writers, because soul writing is something that I've developed and I teach. And it's a written form of meditation. It's writing in an altered state of consciousness. And so if you look at the process of how you do that, and then you look at some of the music that Paul wrote yesterday and Let It Be, and then John, Nowhere Man and Across the Universe, they use that same process. So they admitted this was divinely inspired. This was given to them, right? So it's the same kind of thing. And that's where the meditation kind of comes in, teaching them how to go into that deeper state. And then later on, you know, John actually did a lot more in that area. He was knowledgeable about Kundalini energy and wanting to work with those energies. And so I think that it really opened a door that lasted, you know, till the end of their lives.
Yeah, I just am sitting here thinking about quite a few songs that they wrote where you're right. If you listen to the lyrics, it's really in there. So speaking of John, talk about Yoko. When Yoko Ono came on the scene and maybe throw Linda Eastman in there, I don't know how to proceed with those questions.
Well, no. We as Beatle fans, we really didn't have any boundaries. We were young. We didn't really know. And so to us, the Beatle wives, Beatle girlfriends, were at the same level. So in other words, there were some fan clubs that were started for their wives or their fan clubs. So Cynthia Lennon had her own fan club, you know. So we were invested emotionally in those marriages and in those couplings, because we were kids and we believed in happily ever after, right? We didn't really understand anything about, you know, adult love. And so anyway.
I still don't.
Yeah, right. But anyway, along comes Yoko. And I think with Yoko especially, it was the way that John ended his marriage and the way he treated Cynthia and Julian that we objected to the most, that we found. And so that was reflected in my newsletters, because I was getting letters from members and I could see a faction starting. You got the pro-Yoko and you've got the anti-Yoko. And it was heating up. It was getting pretty serious. Same thing happened when Paul broke up with his girlfriend, Jane Asher. We were fond of Jane. We loved Jane. And then all of a sudden she's gone and here comes Linda Eastman, right? So that same kind of you've ruined everything attitude was pervasive in the fan clubs, and it just caused a lot of animosity. And some of it got really pretty intense to the point where I'm thinking, why am I dealing with this? I had no training as a diplomat or in conflict resolution. I was a kid. So anyway, it caused a lot of separation, I would say. And again, we lost a lot of members because of it, because they couldn't stand the idea of these two together. And some of the stuff that they were doing, especially John and Yoko, was stuff that morally we couldn't integrate into our lives. So the split just got deeper and deeper as a result of that.
You know, I'm listening to this and I don't even know how to ask this question, but you know, we were kind of touching on it during the break, you and I, this idea that the fans, and the fan clubs, right? Like the fans have a tendency to not pay attention to boundaries, and everybody starts to create this idea in their head of who they are, who the Beatles were, or who this famous person is. And they own it in some way that is not healthy, honestly. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And part of it in our case was immaturity, because we were teenagers. Yeah. We hadn't really had any life experience to help us to figure all this out. Many of the girls, the female fans, had fantasies about marrying one of the Beatles one day. Yeah. And so another woman comes in and that becomes on some level, you know, a rival. I know I was writing things that when I saved all my newsletters, by the way, so I've got my newsletters from 64 to 72. And when I went back to do research for this book, I was cringing at some of the things that I thought, oh, Joanne, honestly, how could you be so judgmental? You know, especially, you know, considering who I am today.
Yeah.
But that's the way it was. I mean, there were no boundaries. They were ours. And therefore, they needed to behave the way we wanted them to behave. And if they didn't, then we got angry and we took it out on each other and we took it. And pretty soon, you know, everything just sort of blew up. So that was that. I just, you know, I forgive myself for some of the things that I wrote, because I say, you know, like I said, I was a kid. I didn't know any better. But certainly if you're an adult and you're writing some of the stuff that I printed, and I was using my newsletters almost as a soapbox, because I felt like, hey, I'm doing all the work here. I can say whatever I want to say. Yeah. So then, anyway, there was all kinds of learning experiences during those years.
Yeah, there's so much in there that we could talk about. At some point, you know, toward the end, you write in your book about going to, I think it was at the Bangladesh concert, where you're standing, here you are, the national chapter director, and you wait and wait and wait, and you don't even really meet them, and you don't get tickets, and you're kind of shoved to the side, and it really hurt your feelings, and rightfully so, after everything you'd done. And you write in the book, and I'll let you say, but you came to some sort of a realization about all that. So just talk about that for a second.
Yeah, the Bangladesh concert, Apple had Records had promised us, or the official fan club in New York had promised all of the presidents of the fan clubs and the area secretaries. Every state had its own area secretary. They had promised us tickets and said that they weren't going to buy them for us or give them to us, but we could buy them. So based on that, a lot of us went to New York thinking we were going to see the concert. Luckily for me, I had friends in New York who didn't trust the fan club and went and bought tickets anyway. So that's how I was able to get to the concert. But all through my years, I never went, and there were a lot of fans who'd write to me and go, I went to England and I tracked Paul down at his farm in Scotland, and I stood in front of Apple Records, or I stood in front of Paul's house or whatever. And I thought, how could you do that? That really, I thought, I would never do, that's an imposition. I just think it's, you know, something I would never do. Therefore I never met them. I never put myself in a position where I would meet them. I never wrote them a letter. I didn't make waves. I was more the behind the scenes creative person. So when we went to New York, and my friends in New York who had gone to England and had stood in front of their houses, let's go stand in front of the Park Lane Hotel where George and Ringo were staying. And I thought, oh, no, I'm not going to be seen as a groupie. There's no way. But because they were my friends and they got me the tickets, I did go. It was at the start, it was a really humiliating feeling, you know, and then I was getting pushed. I was getting shoved. I was, I have a picture in my book of Ringo and his wife at that time, Maureen, coming out of the Park Lane. That's as close as I got. Wow. I stood there and I thought, okay, Joanne, you've been doing this for like 7-8 years and you're no better than this person next to you who hasn't done anything, you know, and that's my ego that was talking. Okay. So I understand that, right? Because if I did it out of unconditional love, I shouldn't have wanted any recognition or anything like that. But I did. I was a kid, like I said. So so I realized then it didn't much matter. You know, I'd never get to meet them. I'd never get to talk to them. They'd never know what it was that I had been doing or how much I cared about them. So I thought, you know, my father was pressuring me. I was in college at this point. He says, you're too old to be doing this. And I hadn't had any kind of a personal life as a teenager. So I thought, yeah, it's about time that I let this go. So I did stay for the concert. I had thought about leaving because I was so upset. But I stayed for the concert. I'm glad that I did. And then shortly after that is when the clubs fell apart anyway. So it sort of, you know, events happened that sort of took the decision out of my hands. Yeah, that was the end.
Wow. It's a lot. And I'm also being with the fact that this took up so much of your youth. So everything dismantled, disbanded, you moved on, you went to college, you got married, mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. And so you kind of stepped away from all of it for a while. What brought you back?
Well, actually, the circle was like, I started with the metaphysical books that I was reading before the Beatles. So I was raised, like I said, I was raised Catholic. I had a lot of questions about Catholicism that didn't make any sense to me. And so I started looking and I started reading books about Edgar Cayce. I started reading books written by Jess Stern and Ruth Montgomery. That introduced me to reincarnation, which made a lot of sense. But then the Beatles came and they took over and I forgot about that. 15 years after the Beatles disband, Shirley MacLaine comes out with Out on a Limb. Yeah. They made it into a mini series that ABC ran for a couple of nights. And she's talking about reincarnation and all the light bulb went off. And I'm like, yeah, I remember when, you know. So that's when in 1987 is when I started into my career as a reincarnation researcher and therapist and writer. And so all those years, though, I kept thinking to myself, you know, how did I get here? It made no sense because growing up on the south side of Chicago in that family, Nobody mentioned the word reincarnation. There was nothing in my early life to indicate that I would go in this direction. So I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And I thought, what was I passionate about equal to this passion I have for reincarnation? It was, oh yeah, it was the Beatles. So then I thought, I wonder if they planted that seed. And I didn't even know that they planted the seed. And just now, 15 years later, this is when the seed blossomed. And so that's how I tied that together.
Wow. I love what you just said. I kind of got goosebumps because I'm sitting here thinking it's been 60 years. For me, I still love their music, and they are, you know, they're the Beatles. I know they disbanded and went their own directions, but I do believe they had an imprint upon us, and those songs are still here.
Yes.
I think it's fascinating. I did ask you during the commercial break if you had done any past life regression work around the Beatles, and you said no, which is appropriate, you know. But it makes me real curious about them also and their contracts that they made with each other to be here at this time and bring that about. Yeah.
Yeah, they actually talked about it. I have some quotes in there that they thought that nothing made sense about how they came together, other than this was sort of preordained that they would come together for this singular purpose. And I think for George, it really was to plant the seeds. I think
yeah.
there's some quotes yeah. in there about that's what his job was. So yeah, so they knew that they had some sort of a mystical kind of relationship. They had some agreement on some level to come together and do this. So,
yeah.
And that's the way it works with soul groups and
yeah.
soul families. So yeah, I 100% agree. And that this was one of the best cases of a soul group coming together that I've ever experienced. Thank you, universe.
Thank you. And I'm also, like I said, JFK had been assassinated and the world needed something. I'm also very aware of things like the Swifties and Taylor Swift and these people that are out there, and they're bigger than life, and they have quite a movement. But I want to quote something from your book. I'm going to read it right out of your book from page 162, if anybody has Joanne's book. And you write here, I would not say the Beatles were gods to me, but they were a huge source of spiritual upliftment, joy, and hope. Now that we understand how sound vibrations affect us, I think there was something about their music that changed our brainwaves. They gave us hope, especially in America, where we were suffering from profound grief with the assassination of our president. Their music coincided with the cultural and political revolutions of the 1960s, when we were becoming more compassionate, creative, and passionate about justice. These are all spiritual qualities, in my opinion. Individually, all four Beatles are examples of using fame and wealth for good and living their lives as kind human beings. They certainly had and have their faults, but so do we. And nevertheless, their music and their personalities coalesce to profoundly change the world for the better. Ooh, I love it. So, Joanne, I know you do a lot of work with Edgar Cayce, and how do people find you and all that kind of good stuff right at the end here?
Well, I invite everybody to come to my website, which is joannedimaggio.com, JoanneDimaggio.com. I have a blog on there. You can read case histories about reincarnation, people that have come to me for regressions. If you're interested in a past life regression, I offer several different types. They're all outlined on the website. You can pick the one that's right for you, and then you can actually make your appointment. I do them by Zoom, so I'm dealing with people all over the world, which is wonderful. You can make your appointment online through my online calendar. My books are all on there if you want to get a thumbnail sketch of each of those. And then you can sign up for my monthly newsletter, which has a piece about reincarnation, about there's a soul writing, a piece in there every month, and information on any new projects. I've got a new project on soulmates that I'm doing. That'll be my next book. I was looking for volunteers for that. So information like that's available on the website. So I hope everybody will go there and check it out.
Well, Joanne DiMaggio, it's been a fantastic conversation. The inner light, how the Beatles planted the spiritual seed in our souls. I had 85 more questions, but we'll keep them till next time. And please, thank you. Bless you. Thank you for the good work you're doing on the planet. And Mr. Benny Mathers, you're the best.